she might either bolt or faint.
It's all right, she managed, through the folds of the handkerchief.
It wasn't, but she stiffened her spine, tensed her stomach muscles, and edged up to the makeshift bier on which they'd laid Casimir Pulaski. William stepped up beside her at once. He didn't say anything or touch her, but she was glad of his presence. With a sidelong glance to be sure she wasn't about to faint, Captain Pinckney drew down the sheet. The general was pale, eyes closed, his skin faintly mottled with purplish undertones and a greenish tinge about the jawline. She'd have to adjust that. They might want a death portrait, but she was pretty sure they didn't actually want him to look really dead, just romantically dead. She swallowed and tasted the thick, sweetly nasty air, even through the cloth. She coughed, breathed out strongly through her nose, and moved closer. Romantic is the word, she thought. He had a high brow and a slightly receding hairline, a small dark moustache neatly waxed to make the ends turn up, and his features were an interesting mix of strength and delicacy. He had no expression. He must have lapsed into unconsciousness before he died. And a good thing if he did, poor man. Does he have a wife? She asked, remembering her own feelings when she thought for an instant that Roger... No, Pinckney said. His eyes were fixed on Pulaski's face. He never married. No money, of course, and no interest, really, in women. His family in Poland, Brianna ventured. Perhaps I should make a likeness for them as well. Captain Pinckney lifted his gaze then, but only to exchange a brief glance with Lieutenant Hansen. He didn't speak of them, ma'am, the lieutenant said, and bit his lip, looking down at the dead man. He swallowed audibly. He was kind enough to say that we were his family. I see, she said quietly, and did. For all of you, then. She glanced down at the body, absently noting the details of the clean dress uniform in which they'd clothed him, and wondering morbidly exactly where and how he'd been wounded. Could she ask? There was a deep gash in Pulaski's head, starting just above one temple, the wound a reddish black, with tiny crumbs of blackened skin along its edges. Looking closer, where the gash disappeared under the general's hair, she thought she perceived, without thinking, she put out a finger and felt the cold skull give under her touch, light as it was. She heard Captain Pinckney draw in a sharp breath and hastily remove the finger. Grapeshot? William asked, sounding mildly interested. Yes, sir, Captain Pinckney replied, with an air of sombre rebuke that she felt was aimed at her. He was struck in several places, in the body and head. Poor man, Brianna said softly. She felt a strong urge to touch him again, to lay a hand gently on his chest, covered by the silver-banded red facing of his uniform. The uniform had a high collar made of some kind of white fur. No, it was lamb's wool, lined with grubby pink velvet, but felt she couldn't under the censorious gaze of the captain.
The doctor, our doctor, thought he might be saved.
Pinckney had lowered his voice discreetly, talking directly to William.
He was conscious, speaking, but he insisted upon being taken aboard the Wasp and the Navy doctor.
He cleared his throat explosively and took a deep breath.
It was the wound in his groin that went bad, or so I was told.
A great shame, sir, William said, and clearly meant it. A very gallant gentleman.
Yes, sir, the captain said,
and she could tell that he had warmed toward William.
I understand that my sister is to make a likeness of the general, William said, and she looked up.
He nodded to her, then tilted his head toward the captain.
Would you tell Captain Pinckney what things you require for the task, sister?
Hearing the word sister in his voice again gave her an odd little bloom of warmth in the middle of her chest.
And while things are being prepared, he added, before she could speak, perhaps she might be given something to eat. We came at once in answer to General Lincoln's request.
Oh, of course, certainly.
The captain looked over his shoulder,
Lieutenant Hansen, will you see to finding something for the lady and her escorts? To be eaten somewhere else, William said firmly.
Light. That was the first thing. And somewhere to sit. A place to set her implements. A cup of water.
That's really all I need, she said, with a glance back toward the silent tent.
She hesitated for a moment.
I don't know whether you were thinking that you'd like, eventually, I mean, like a painting of the general, or a, were you thinking just a drawing or drawings? The message just said a likeness, I mean, and I can do whatever you like, though all I can do today is to make sketches and notes for a more formal likeness.
Oh. Captain Pinckney drew a deep breath, frowning, and she saw his eyes slide sideways for an instant, then back to her. He straightened his shoulders.
I don't believe that has been decided as yet, Mrs. Mackenzie, but I do assure you that you will be compensated adequately for whatever form the likeness may take. I will guarantee that personally.
Oh, I wasn't worried about that. She flushed slightly with embarrassment.
I hadn't expected to be paid. I intended from the start to do this just as a gesture of goodwill. In support of the army, I mean.
All four men stared at her with varying degrees of astonishment. Her flush grew hotter.
It hadn't occurred to her that Lord John hadn't told William she was a rebel. Dr. Wallace undoubtedly knew her political allegiance, but perhaps had thought it more discreet not to mention it. And she'd been staying in a loyalist household in a city under British occupation, employed by a very prominent loyalist. Well, the cat was out of the bag now. She gave William a level look and raised one brow. He raised one back at her and looked away. It was mid-afternoon. The light was going already. It will be dark in a couple of hours. There would be candles, Captain Pinckney assured her, as many as she wanted, or a lantern, perhaps.
Perhaps, she said. I'll make as many sketches as I can. How long?
Given the stench of the dead man, she imagined they must be wanting to get him underground as quickly as possible. We'll bury him with the proper honours tomorrow morning, Captain Pinckney said, correctly interpreting her question. The men will come this evening after supper to pay their respects. Will that be all right? She was taken aback, but only for a moment, imagining this process of visitation.
Yes, perfectly all right, she said firmly. I'll draw them too.
Chapter 95 Pozegnania. She sat unobtrusive in the shadows. Head bent, the soft shush of her charcoal lost in the clearing of throats, the rustle of clothing. But she watched them, in ones and twos and threes, as they ducked under the open tent flap and came to the general's side. There each man paused to look on his face, calm in the candlelight, and she caught what she could of the drifting currents that crossed their own faces, shadows of grief and sorrow, eyes sometimes dark with fear, or blank with shock and tiredness. Often they wept. William and John Cinnamon flanked her, standing just behind on either side, silent and respectful. General Lincoln's orderly had offered them stools, but they had courteously refused, and she found their buttressing presences oddly comforting. The soldiers came by companies, the uniforms, in some cases only militia badges, changing. John Cinnamon shifted his weight now and then and occasionally took a deep breath or cleared his throat. William didn't. What was he doing, she wondered, counting the soldiers, assessing the condition of the American troops? They were shabby, dirty and unkempt, and in spite of their respectful demeanour, few of the companies seemed to have any notion of order. For the first time it occurred to her to wonder just what William's motive in coming had been. She'd been so happy at meeting him that she'd accepted his statement that he wouldn't let his sister go unaccompanied into a military camp at face value. Was it true, though?
From the little Lord John had said, she knew that William had resigned his army commission, but that didn't mean he'd changed sides, or that he had no interest in the state of the American siege, or that he didn't intend to pass on any information he gained during this visit.
"I was a soldier," he'd said.
Clearly, he still knew people in the British Army.
The skin on her shoulders prickled at the thought, and she wanted to turn round and look up at him. A moment's hesitation, and she did just that. His face was grave, but he was looking at her.
"All right?"
he asked in a whisper.
"Yes," she said, comforted by his voice. "I just wondered whether you'd fallen asleep standing up."
"Not yet."
She smiled and opened her mouth to say something, apologize for keeping him and his friend out all night. He stopped her with a small twitch of fingers.
"It's all right," he said softly. "You do what you came to do. We'll stay with you and take you home in the morning. I meant it. I won't leave you alone."
She swallowed. "I know you did," she said, just as softly. "Thank you." There was an audible stir outside. The procession of shuffling soldiers had stopped. She sat up straight and felt the two men behind her shift. She caught a low murmur from William.
"This will be General Lincoln, I expect."
John Cinnamon made an inquisitive huffing noise but said nothing, and an instant later the tent flap was pulled well back, and a very fat, stocky man in full continental uniform, complete with cocked hat, limped in, followed by a close-packed group of officers in a variety of uniforms. It had begun to rain, and a welcome breath of cool, damp air came in with them. She slipped her sketches into the writing desk and took out a few fresh sheets, but didn't return to her work right away. She didn't want to draw attention to herself. This was history, right in front of her. Her heart had been quiet through the evening, but now it sped up and began to thump heavily in an unpleasant way that made her worry that it was about to run amok. She pressed a hand hard against the placket of her stays and mentally uttered a fierce, "Stay!" as though her heart were a large, unruly dog. The general stopped short beside the body, coughed. Everyone did. The smell was growing worse despite the cool night, and slowly removed his hat. He turned to murmur something to the man at his shoulder. A Frenchman? She thought Lincoln was speaking French, though very awkwardly, and she caught another whiff of rain and night and saw the droplets that he shook from his hat make spots in the shadowed dust. Lincoln beckoned three of the men forward. "French," said the objective watcher in the back of her mind, and her pencil made rapid strokes, rough indications of embroidery, epaulettes, full-skirted blue coats, red waistcoats, and breeches. The three men, naval officers, stepped forward, one in front, his lavishly gold-laced hat held solemnly to his bosom. She heard William make a low humming noise in his throat. Was this Admiral D'Estaing himself? She leaned forward a little, not sketching now, but memorizing, storing away the play of firelight through the tense wall on the officer's face, the pitter of rain on the canvas above. The Admiral, if that's who he was slender but round-faced, jowly, but with oddly childlike wide eyes and a plump little mouth. He murmured a few words in formal French, then leaned forward and placed a hand on General Pulaski's chest. The general farted. It was a long, loud, rumbling fart, and the night was filled with a stench so terrible that Brianna huffed out all the air in her lungs in a vain effort to escape it. Someone laughed, out of sheer shock. It was a high-pitched giggle, and for a moment she thought she'd done it herself, and clapped a hand to her mouth. The tent dissolved into embarrassed, half-stifled laughter, punctuated by gasps and choking, as the entire rotting essence of General Pulaski's insides filled the atmosphere. Admiral D'Estaing turned hastily aside and threw up in the corner. She had to breathe. She grunted as though the smell had punched her and her stomach puckered. It was like breathing rancid lard, a fatty foulness that slicked the inside of her nose and throat.
"Come on,
William grabbed her by one arm, John Cinnamon by the other, and they had her out of the tent in a ruthless instant, knocking General Lincoln out of their way. It was raining hard outside by now, and she gulped air and water, breathing as deep as she could. Oh, God, oh, God, oh, God!
Was it worse, do you think, than the dead bear in the wood above Garion?
John Cinnamon asked William in a meditative voice.
Lots, William assured him.
Oh, Jesus, I'm going to be sick. No, wait. He bent over, arms folded over his stomach, and gulped heavily for a moment, then straightened up.
No, it's all right.
I'm not.
Are you? He asked Brianna.
She shook her head. Cold water was running down her face and her sleeves were pasted to her arms, but she didn't care. She would have jumped through a hole in Arctic ice to cleanse herself of that. A slime of rotten onions seemed to cling to her palate. She cleared her throat hard and spat on the ground.
My sketchbox, she said, wiping her mouth and looking toward the tent.
There had been a general hasty exodus, and men were scattering in every direction. Admiral D'Estaing and his officers were jostling down a footpath toward a large, lighted green tent that glowed like an uncut emerald in the distance. General Lincoln, his hat full of rain, was looking about helplessly as his adjutants and orderlies tried in vain to keep a torch lighted. General Pulaski's resting place, by contrast, was deserted and pitch dark.
He put the candles out, said William, and sniggered very briefly. Good thing the tent didn't explode.
That would have been quite fun, Cinnamon said with obvious regret, and fitting too for a hero. Still, your sister's drawings. I'll toss you to see who goes in to get them.
He fumbled in his pocket and withdrew a shilling.
Tails, said William at once.
Cinnamon tossed, caught the coin on the back of his hand with a slap, and peered at it.
I can't see.
If there was a moon, it was covered with rain clouds, and the pouring night was dark as a wet black blanket. Here! Brianna reached out and ran her fingertips over the wet, cold face of the coin. And it was a face, though she couldn't tell whose. Heads, she said.
Sturcus, William said briefly,
and unwinding his wet stock, rewound it around his lower face and plunged down the path toward the dark tent.
Sturcus? Bree repeated, turning to John Cinnamon.
It means shit in Latin, the big Indian explained. You aren't a Catholic, are you?
I am, she said, surprised, and I do know some Latin, but I'm pretty sure Sturcus isn't in the Mass.
Not one I've ever heard, he assured her. I thought you wouldn't be Catholic, though. William isn't.
No. She hesitated, wondering just how much this man knew about William and the complications of their shared paternity. Have you been travelling with William for some time?
A couple of months. He didn't tell me about you, though.
I suppose he wouldn't have.
She paused, not sure whether to ask what, if anything, William had told him. Before she could decide, William himself was back, gasping and gagging, the sketchbox under his arm. He thrust it at her, yanked the stock down off his face, turned aside, and threw up.
Phileas Scorti, he said, breathless, and spat. That was the worst. Mrs. Mackenzie?
A familiar voice came out of the darkness, interrupting him.
Is that you, ma'am?
It was Lieutenant Hansom, drenched to the skin, but holding a dark lantern. The rain plinked on its metal, and water vapour drifted through the slit of light.
Over here, she called,
and the lantern turned in their direction, the rain suddenly visible, needles of silver falling through the light.
Come with me, ma'am, Lieutenant Hansom said, reaching them. I found some shelter for you and your... Thank God, William said. And thank you too, Lieutenant, he added, bowing. Of course.
Sir, Hansom said uncertainly. He lifted the lantern, showing them the path, and Bree thanked him and started down it, followed by William and Cinnamon.
She heard a small noise from one of them, though, and turned round. Lieutenant Hansom had stopped, looking toward the tent where Casimir Pulaski lay in darkness.
Hansen lifted the lantern a little in salute, and in a low, clear voice said, "Pozignanya." Then he turned with decision and came toward his waiting charges.
"It means farewell in Polish," he said to Brianna, matter-of-factly. "He used to say that to us when he left us for the night."
Chapter 96. One Thing of Value. The small wooden structure to which Lieutenant Hansen escorted them might originally have been a chicken coop, Brianna thought, ducking beneath the flimsy lintel. Someone had been living in it, though. There were two rough pallets with blankets on the floor, a chipped and stained pottery ewer and basin between them, and an enameled tin chamber pot in much better condition.
"I do apologize, ma'am," Lieutenant Hansen said for the dozenth time, "but half our tents have blown away and the men are holding down the rest."
He held his lantern up, peering dubiously at the dark splotches seeping through the boards of one wall.
"It seems not to be leaking too badly, yet."
"It's perfectly fine," Brianna assured him, hunching out of the way so her two large escorts could squeeze in behind her. With four people inside the shed, there was literally no room to turn around, let alone lie down, and she clutched her sketchbox under her cloak, not wanting it to be trampled.
"We are obliged to you, Lieutenant."
William was bent nearly double under the low ceiling, but managed a nod in Hansen's direction.
"Food?"
"Directly, sir,"
Hansen assured him.
"I'm sorry there's no fire, but at least you'll be out of the rain.
Good night, Mrs. Mackenzie,
and thank you again."
He squirmed past the bulk of John Cinnamon and disappeared into the blustery night, clutching his hat to his head.
"Take that one," William said to Brianna, jerking his chin at the bedsack farthest from the leaking wall. "Cinnamon and I will take the other in shifts."
She was too tired to argue with him. She laid down her sketchbox, shook the blanket, and when no bedbugs, lice, or spiders fell out, sat down, feeling like a puppet whose strings had just been cut. She closed her eyes, hearing William and John Cinnamon negotiate their movements, but letting the low voices wash over her like the wind and rain outside. Images crowded the backs of her eyes, the trampled grass of the shoreline trail, the suspicious faces of the Highlanders at the edge of the city, the ever-changing light on the dead man's face. Her brother jerking his chin in exactly the way her father did. Dark streaks of water and white streaks of chicken shit on silvered boards in the lantern light.
Light.
It seemed 1,000 years since she'd watched the morning sun glow pink through Angelina Brumby's small, sweet ear. And Roger. At least Roger was alive, wherever he was right now. She opened her eyes on darkness, feeling a hand on her shoulder.
"Don't fall asleep before you eat something," William said, sounding amused. "I promised to see you fed, and I shouldn't like to break my word."
"Food?" She shook her head, blinking. A sudden glow rose behind William, and she saw the big Indian set down a clay firepot next to the stubby candle he'd just lit. He tilted the candle over the bottom of the upturned chamber pot, then stuck it into the melted wax, holding it until the wax hardened.
"Sorry, I should have asked if you wanted to piss first," Cinnamon said, looking at her apologetically. "Only there's no place else to put the candle."
"No," she said, and shook her head to clear it. "That's all right. Is there anything to drink?" She'd drunk almost nothing during the day and evening, and felt dry as a winter husk in spite of the prevailing damp. Lieutenant Hansen had managed to find several bottles of beer, some slices of cold roast pork, rimmed with grease, a loaf of dry, dark bread, a pot of strong mustard, and a large lump of crumbling cheese. She'd never eaten anything better in her life. They didn't talk. The men ate with the same single-mindedness as she did, and, the last crumb finished, she eased herself down flat on the blanket, wrapped her cloak around her, and fell asleep without a word. She dreamed,
caught in the uneasy chill between sleep and waking. She dreamed of men. Men as shadows, slow with grief. Men at work, their sweat running down bare arms, scarred backs. Men walking in ranks, their uniforms black with wet, splashed with mud, no telling who they were. A tiny boy rooting at her breast with great determination, unaware that he was helpless. She woke every now and then, briefly, but seldom broke the surface of the dream, and fell back slowly into sleep with a sense of men. And chickens lending odd stumpy wings to a man flying upward into the sun. She woke slowly to the sensation of wings beating in her chest. Shit, she said, but softly, and pressed her palm hard against her breastbone. As usual, this accomplished nothing, and she lay still, breathing as shallowly as possible, hoping it would stop. She was lying on her side, and her brother's face was a foot from hers, shadowed but visible as he lay asleep on the other pallet. The rain had stopped. The wind had dropped, and she could hear water dripping from the eaves of the shed. Moonlight filtered through cracks in the boards, flickering on and off as clouds raced past. And the flutter in her chest eased, and her heart bumped two or three times, then resumed its usual rhythm. She took a cautious breath and sat up slowly, not to wake William, but he was dead asleep, long body sprawled limp with exhaustion. "There's water," said a soft voice to her right. "Do you want some?" "Please." Her tongue clicked from dryness, and she reached toward the vast shadow that must be John Cinnamon. He was sitting on the upturned chamber pot as he leaned forward and put a small canteen into her hand. The water was fresh and cool, with a pleasant metallic taste from the tin, and she drank thirstily, just managing to stop without draining the canteen entirely. She handed it back reluctantly and wiped her mouth with the back of her hand. "Thank you." He made a small grunt in response and leaned back. The boards of the shed wall creaked in protest. Now she really did need to piss, she realized. Well, no way round it. She got clumsily to her feet, and Cinnamon rose too, much more gracefully, and seized her by the arm to stop her falling. I'm going outside for a moment. Oh. He let go her arm, hesitant, and half turned toward the upside-down chamber pot as though to right it. No, it's all right. The rain stopped. The door of the shed was stuck, swollen with the wet. He reached past her and freed it with a jolt of his palm. Fresh, cold air rushed into the shed, and she heard a rustle as William stirred. I'll go first. Cinnamon whispered in her ear as he somehow slid past her. You wait till I call. But he was gone, leaving the door slightly ajar. She cast a quick glance at William, but he had sunk back into slumber. She could hear a faint snore from the darkness and smiled at the sound. As quietly as she could, she pushed the ramshackle door open and stuck her head out. The night spread overhead in a silent rush. Bright-edged clouds racing past a bright half-moon. She could hear the drip of water more clearly out here, falling from the leaves of a big tree that stood by the chicken shed. She could hear a steadier splash of water, too, and smiled again. John Cinnamon had taken the opportunity for discreet relief of his own. She turned in the other direction and retired under the shadow of the big tree, in spite of the drips, where she accomplished her own business without ceremony. I'm just here, she said, emerging in time to forestall Cinnamon's calling her. He turned from the shed door sharply, then nodded, seeing her. He made a slight inquisitive motion toward the shed, but she shook her head. Not yet. I need a little air. She tilted back her head and breathed, grateful for the freshness of the night, and for the stars appearing and vanishing overhead, vivid in the patches of black night scoured by the passing clouds. John Cinnamon kept her company, though he didn't speak. She could feel his presence, large and reassuring. "Have you known my brother long?" she asked at last. He lifted a shoulder in equivocation. "Yes and no,"
he said. We spent a winter together in Quebec.
When? Maybe 3 years ago. I was a guide for him, a scout. And then we met again by accident, 3 months ago, about that.
Where did you meet this time? She asked, curious. In Canada?
Oh, no. In Virginia.
He turned his head at a sudden cracking noise, but then dismissed it.
A broken branch falling. It was a place called Mount Josiah. Do you know it?
I've heard of it. What brought you there? He made a small humming sound, but nodded, deciding to tell her.
Lord John Grey. Do you know his lordship?
Yes, very well, she said, smiling at the memory. Was he in Virginia then?
No, Cinnamon said thoughtfully, but your brother was.
Oh, was he looking for Lord John as well?
I don't think so.
He stood silent for a moment, then added,
he was looking for other things. Maybe he'll tell you. I can't.
I see, she said, wondering. Shocked and moved by meeting William, she hadn't had time to wonder, let alone ask, what had led him to Savannah, why he had resigned his army commission, what he thought about his two fathers, what he thought about her, who he was. Her father had said almost nothing about William, and she hadn't asked. Time enough, she'd felt, but the time had evidently come. Still, she didn't want to pry or discomfort John Cinnamon by asking whether, or what, he knew about Jamie Fraser. William said that he, or rather you, wanted a portrait made, she said, changing to what seemed safer ground. I'll be very happy to do that. Is it meant for some lucky lady? That surprised him, and he laughed, a low, warm sound.
No, I don't have a woman. I mean to send it to my father, he said.
Your father? Where is he? The clouds had shredded, and the light of a setting moon showed her his broad face, soft-eyed now and thoughtful. He would be wonderful to paint.
London, he said, surprising her.
He saw that he had surprised her, and ducked his head, abashed.
I am a bastard, of course, he said, with a tone of apology. My father was a British soldier. He got me on an Indian woman in Canada.
I see. There didn't seem anything else she could say, and he gave her a small, shy smile.
Yes, I thought for many years. I thought that Lord John was my father. It was him who took me when my mother died. I was an infant, and gave me to the Holy Fathers at the mission on Garion. He sent money for my keeping, you see.
That seems very like him, she said, though in fact she would never have thought of him doing such a thing.
He is a kind man, very kind, he added firmly. William brought me to Savannah to talk to him. William thought Lord John to be my father too, and it was his lordship who told me the truth. My real father abandoned me. Such things are common.
His voice was matter of fact. Probably such things were common. That doesn't mean it's right, she said, angry at the unknown father. He shrugged.
But Lord John told me his name and a direction. I know how to send the picture to him.
You want a portrait for a man who abandoned you? But why? She spoke cautiously. This young man was patently a realist. Did he really think that a portrait of his half-breed child, now grown, would move the sort of selfish, cold-hearted oaf who...
I don't think he will acknowledge me, he assured her. I don't want him to. I don't want money or anything he might value. But he has one thing that I want, and I hope that if he sees my face, he will give it to me.
What on earth is that? Even the dripping from the trees had ceased by now. The night was so still that she could hear him swallow.
I want to know my name, he said, so low she scarcely heard him. I want to know the name my mother called me. He's the only one who knows that.
Her throat was too tight to speak. She stepped toward him and put her arms around him, holding him as his mother might have,
had she lived to see him grown. "I promise you," she whispered when she could speak, "your face will break his heart."
He patted her back very gently and stepped back.
"You're very kind," he said. "You should sleep now."
Chapter 97. An excellent question. John Cinnamon tactfully left William and Brianna soon after they made their way back through the debris of the Abertees line into the city, saying that he had business at the riverfront and would see William later at Lord John's house. "I like your friend a lot," Brianna said, watching Cinnamon's broad back disappear into the dappled sunlight of a square whose name she didn't know.
"So do I. I only hope..."
William checked himself, but his sister turned to him, a sympathetic expression on her face.
"Me too," she said. "You mean London and this Matthew Stubbs?"
"Malcolm, but yes."
"What sort of man is he?" she asked curiously. "Have you met him?"
"Yes, twice that I recall. Once at Ascot and once at one of Lord John's clubs."
He glanced at her to see whether she'd noticed, but of course she had.
"It's okay. All right, I mean, to call Lord John your father," she said, the expression of sympathy transferring itself to him.
"I wouldn't mind."
Blood rose in his cheeks, but he was saved from saying what he thought about Jamie Fraser's preferences in the matter by Brianna's instantly returning to the subject of Malcolm Stubbs.
"So, what's he like, this Stubbs?"
He couldn't help a smile at the suspicious tone of this Stubbs.
"To look at, very aptly named. Short and thick, with hair just like Cinnamon's, though it's a sort of sandy blonde. It may be grey by now, though," he added. "He always wears a wig in public."
She lifted her brows at him, thick brows for a woman, and red to boot, but very expressive.
"I don't know," he said honestly, in response to the brow's question. "There's the one thing that might help. Papa, he said, giving her a brief glare that dared her to comment, "told me that he has a black wife. Stubbs has, I mean," he amended, "not Papa."
She blinked.
"In London?"
She sounded so shocked that he laughed.
"Why should the place make a difference? I imagine she'd be just as surprising here."
He waved a hand at the stately shattered houses surrounding St. James's Square.
"If not more so."
She said. Then, curiously, "Did he free her from slavery and then marry her?"
"She wasn't a slave," William said, somewhat surprised.
"My father said that he and Stubbs both, he meant, had met her in Cuba. Stubbs's first wife had just died of some sort of fever, and he brought this woman, Inocencia, that's her name, I knew it was some sort of Spanish virtue, brought her back to London with him and married her. Anyway," he said, bringing the conversation back to its point, "I'm sure that Papa said Stubbs had children by this woman."
"You mean he wouldn't necessarily turn his back on John Cinnamon because of being..." She waved a hand, indicating Cinnamon's noticeable Indianness.
"Yes."
William felt doubtful, despite the firmness of his answer. Having children of an unusual hue would cause comment, but wasn't necessarily a scandalous thing, provided they were legitimate, which the junior Stubbses certainly were. Having an enormous and very obviously extra-legal adult Indian turn up and claim parentage might well be a horse of a different colour. And he found that he very much wanted John Cinnamon not to be hurt. Brianna made a clicking noise, and her horse moved obligingly out of the shade of the live oaks and into Jones Street. There were a large number of people out, William saw. Overnight, the sense of fearful oppression had lifted with the siege, and while the smell of burning still tinged the air and broken tree limbs were scattered everywhere, people had to eat, and business must be done. The normal tide of daily life was coming in apace.
"Will you go with him to London?" Brianna asked over her shoulder.
She nudged her horse with both heels, reining him out of the way of an oncoming wagon filled with barrels and sweetly smelling of beer.
London, William repeated.
I don't know.
He didn't, and let so much uncertainty show in his voice that his sister pulled up a bit to wait for him, then nodded toward a lane that ran behind the Baptist church, indicating that he should follow her.
It's not my business, she said, as they passed into the cold shadow of the church.
But what are you planning to do? I mean, now the siege is lifted. I suppose you can go anywhere you want.
Excellent question.
I don't know, he said honestly. Truly, I don't.
She nodded.
Well, you have options, don't you?
Options,
he said. He was amused, but the word still gave him a sense that he'd swallowed a live eel.
You have no idea, sister mine.
Lord John says you own a small plantation in Virginia, she pointed out. If you didn't want to go back to England, I suppose you could live there.
It's possible, I suppose.
He could hear the doubt in his own voice, and so could she. She glanced sharply at him, eyebrow lifted.
The place is a ruin, he said, though the fields have been kept in fairly good condition. But the war...
He gestured at the nearest house, popped by cannonballs, and its bright blue paint scorched and fire-blackened on one side.
I think it might not just flow round me like a rock in the water, you know.
Something odd moved over her face, and he looked at her in considerable surprise.
You've thought of something? He asked.
Yes, but it's not... I mean, it's not relevant right this minute. She waved away whatever the thought had been.
I know Lord John and your uncle. The Duke still thinks of himself as your uncle, I know.
So do I,
William said wryly, but with a small sense of relief at the thought. Uncle Hal truly was a rock, over whom floods and torrents had often passed, leaving him unmoved.
They want you to go back to England, Brianna said. I was wondering myself. You're an earl. Doesn't that mean you have people, land, things that need taking care of?
There is an estate, yes, he said tersely.
I... What the devil?
His horse had stopped dead, and Brianna's mount was trying to turn around in the alley, waffling at some disturbing scent. Then his feebler olfactory sense perceived it too. A stink of death. A wagon stood at the end of the alley, its sides draped with black cloth. This threadbare and bleached by age into rusty folds. The wagon was unhitched, and there were neither horses nor mules in evidence, but a small group of roughly clad men, both black and white, stood in a patch of sun just beyond the alley's mouth, in attitudes of watchful expectation. There was a sound of voices in the distance, subdued, but several of them. A murmuring that was punctuated abruptly by a piercing wail that made the waiting men flinch and look away, shoulders hunched. Brianna turned in her saddle, looking over her shoulder, and gathering up her reins, evidently wanting to go back, but there were people coming into the alley behind them, mourners in dark veils and armbands. Bree glanced at William, and he shook his head and nudged his own horse toward hers, jockeying toward the side of the alley, in order to give the newcomers space to pass. This they did, a few sparing a glance at the riders.
One or two, with eyes widened at sight of Brianna, astride with her skirts hiked up and an indecent expanse of calf showing, but most so focused on present grief as to be indifferent to spectacle.
Movement near the wagon drew William's attention back. They were bringing out the body. Bodies. He whipped off his hat, pressed it to his heart, and bowed his head. To his astonishment, Brianna did the same. There were no coffins. This was a funeral of the poor. Two small bodies wrapped in rough shrouds were borne out on planks and gently lifted into the wagon.
No, no!
A woman, who must be the children's mother, broke from the arms of her supporters and ran to the wagon, trying to climb in, screaming, "No!" at the top of her voice.
"No, no,
Let me go with them. Don't take them away from me. No!
A wave of horrified, stricken friends closed round the woman, pulling her back, trying by sheer force of compassion to quiet her.
Oh, dear God,
Brianna said in a choked voice. William glanced at her and saw that tears were running down her face, her eyes fixed on the pitiful scene, and he recalled with a shock the children he had heard playing outside the Brumby house. Hers. He reached out a hand and grasped her arm. She let go of the reins with that hand and seized his as though she were drowning, clinging for dear life. Remarkable strength for a woman. Several men had come to take out the shafts, and the wagon's wheels creaked into motion, the small procession beginning its mournful journey. The mother had ceased wailing now. She moved as though sleepwalking after the wagon, stumbling as her knees gave way, every few steps in spite of the support of two women who held her up. "Where's her husband?" Brianna whispered, more to herself than to William, but he answered, "He'll likely be with the army." Much more likely he was dead as well. But his sister probably knew that as well as he did. Her own husband. God knew where he was. She'd avoided answering him when he'd asked, but it was apparent that Mackenzie was a rebel, if he'd been in the recent battle. But no, he'd survived that at least, William reminded himself. She didn't ask about him while we were in camp. Why the devil not? Still, he could feel a small, constant tremor running through his sister's hand, and he squeezed back, trying to give her reassurance. "Monsieur?" A high-pitched voice by his left stirrup startled him, and he jerked in the saddle, making his horse shift and stamp. "What?" he said, looking down incredulously. "Who the devil are you?" The small black boy. Christ, he was wearing the remnants of a dark blue uniform, so he must be, or recently had been, a drummer, bowed solemnly. His face, ear, and hand were black with soot on one side, and there was a deal of blood on his clothes, but he didn't seem to be wounded.
"Pardon, monsieur, parlez-vous français?"
"Oui," William replied, astonished.
"Pourquoi?"
The child? No, he was older than he looked. He stood up straight and looked William in the eye, maybe 11 or 12. Coughed up a wad of black phlegm and spat it out, then shook his head as though straightening his wits.
"Votre ami a besoin d'aide, le grand indien?"
he added as an afterthought. "Is he saying something about John Cinnamon?" Brianna asked, frowning. She brushed at the tears streaking her face and sat up straight, gathering her own wits.
"Yes, he says..." "I take it you don't speak French?"
"Some." She gave him a look.
"Right."
He turned to the boy, who was swaying gently to and fro, staring at something invisible, plainly in the grip of exhaustion.
"Dites-moi, vite."
This the boy did, with admirable simplicity.
"Sturcus,"
William muttered, then turned to his sister. "He says a press gang from the French ships heard Cinnamon speaking French to someone on the shore. They followed him and tried to take him. He got away from them, but he's hiding, the boy says, in a cave, though that seems unlikely. Anyway, he needs help."
"Let's go, then."
She gathered up her reins and looked behind her, judging the turning space. He'd almost given up being surprised by her, but evidently not quite.
"Are you insane?"
he inquired, as politely as possible.
"Stay,"
he added firmly to his own horse.
"What language are you speaking now?"
she said, seeming impatient.
"Steh" is German for stand still when talking to a horse.
"And Sturcus means shit," he informed her crisply. "You have children, madam, like the ones you have just been weeping over. If you don't want yours to be similarly afflicted, I suggest you go home and tend them." The blood shot up into her face as though someone had lit a fire under her skin, and she glared at him, gathering up the loose ends of her reins in one hand in a manner suggesting that she was considering lashing him across the face with them.
"You little bastard,"
she began, and then pressed her lips together, cutting off the word.
"Bastard," he finished for her.
"Yes, I am. Go home." And turning his back on her, he reached down a hand to the boy and lifted him till he could get a foot on the stirrup,
and scramble up behind. "Où allons-nous?" he asked briefly, and the boy pointed behind them toward the river. A large feminine hand grabbed his horse's bridle. The horse snorted and shook his head in protest, but she held on. "Has anyone ever told you that being reckless will get you killed?" she asked, imitating his polite tone. "Not that I care that much, but you'll likely get this kid as well as John Cinnamon killed, too." "Kid," was all he could think of saying, for the collision of words trying to get out of his mouth. "Child, boy, lad, him," she snapped, jerking her chin toward the little drummer behind him.
"Quel est le problème de cette femme?"
the boy demanded indignantly.
"Je sais, je ne sais pas," William said briefly over his shoulder. "God knows I don't."
"Will you bloody let go?" he said to his sister.
"In a minute, yes," Brianna said, fixing him with a dark blue glare.
"Listen to me." He rolled his eyes but gave her a short, sharp nod and a glare in return. She sat back in her saddle a bit but didn't let go.
"Good," she said.
"I walked up and down that shore nearly every day before the Americans showed up, and my children poked into every cranny in those bluffs. There are only four places that could possibly be called caves, and only one of them is deep enough that somebody Cinnamon size could have a hope of hiding in." She paused for breath and wiped her free hand under her nose, eyeing him to see if he was paying attention.
"I hear you," he said testily, "and?"
"And that one isn't a cave at all. It's the end of a tunnel." The flush of temper left him abruptly.
"Where's the other end?"
She smiled slightly and let go of the bridle. "See? You may be reckless, but I knew you weren't stupid. The other end is in the cellar of a tavern on Broad Street. They call it the Pirate's House, and so far as I know from the talk in town, there's a good reason for that. But if I were you..." He snorted briefly and gathered up his reins. The end of the alley was clear now, emptied of wagon, mourners, and small, shrouded bodies.
"You are my sister, madam," he said, and with no more than an instant's hesitation added, "and I'm glad of that. But you're not my mother. In fact, I'm not stupid, and neither is John Cinnamon."
He paused for an instant, then added, "Thank you, though." "Good luck," she said simply, and sat watching as he turned and rode away. Brianna didn't leave the alley at once. She watched William ride out, back stiff with determination, the boy clinging to his waist. From the looks of it, the child had never sat on a horse before, was terrified, and was damned if he'd admit it. Between him and William, she thought John Cinnamon might have chosen worse in terms of allies. She quivered with the urge to follow William, not to let him go alone. But he was, damn him, right. She couldn't risk something happening to her, not with Jem and Mandy. She gathered her reins and clicked her tongue. More people were coming through the square toward the church, soberly dressed, walking close together. This church had no bell, but one was ringing, tolling, somewhere across the city. More funerals, she thought, and her heart squeezed tight in her chest. Slowly she rode out among the mourners and turned up Abercorn Street. "How many people can you worry about at once?" she wondered. "Jem, Mandy, Roger, Fanny, her parents, now William and John Cinnamon." She was still shaken by the dead children and their mother. This, on top of a night spent in the marshes with Casimir Pulaski, made her feel as though her skin was about to peel off. A sudden memory of her last sight of the general surged into her mind, and a high, completely unhinged giggle escaped her, just as suddenly bile rose in her throat and her stomach turned over. Oh, God! She fought down the surge of nausea, but saw that people were staring at her, and realized that in addition to laughing like a loon, she was still clutching her tree-corn in one hand, her hair blowing loose, and her legs scratched and mosquito-bitten, bare from knees to absurdly elaborate shoe-tops.
She'd taken off her wet stockings the night before and forgotten to find them in the morning. Suddenly embarrassed by the sidelong glances and whispers, she straightened up defiantly, shoulders back. A big hand clutched the bare calf of her leg, and she yelped and swatted whoever it was with her hat, making the horse shy violently. Who it was Roger, who shied violently too.
Christ!
Shit! I mean, S-word, she said, grappling her horse back under control. What did you do that for?
I called, but you didn't hear me.
He slapped the horse companionably on the withers and reached up a hand to her. He looked tired, and his eyes were creased with worry.
Come down and tell me what the devil's been happening. Did you go to the American camp? I shouldn't have asked you to. God, you look like death.
Her hands were actually shaking, and in fact, she realized, she felt rather like death. When her feet touched the ground, she nearly fell into his arms, hugging him, and began to live again. Chapter 98 Minerva Joy. Lord John returned from a visit to the local hospital, where the British wounded, along with those Savannah inhabitants injured by flying splinters or house fires, were being treated, to find his brother sitting at his desk in the study, looking as though he'd been struck by lightning.
"Hal?" John said, alarmed. "What's happened?"
Hal's mouth opened, but only a small wheezing noise came out. There was an opened letter on the desk, looking as though it had travelled some distance through rain and mud and possibly been trampled by a horse along the way. Hal pushed this wordlessly toward him, and he picked it up. "Friend Pardlow, I write in torment of mind and spirit, which is increased by the knowledge that I must oblige thee now to share it. Forgive me. Dorothea gave birth to a healthy girl, whom we named Minerva Joy. She was born within the precincts of the prison at Stony Point, as I was confined there, and I would not trust Dorothea's welfare to the local midwife, whose competence I doubted. Mina, as we called her, thrived and bloomed, as did her mother. There was an outbreak of fever within the prison, though, and fearing for their health, I sent them into the town where they took refuge with a Quaker family. Alas, no more than a week after their departure, I received a note from the husband of this family, with the dreadful news that two members of his own family had fallen ill with a bloody flux, and that my own dear one showed signs of the same disease. I sought leave at once to go to treat my family, and was reluctantly granted a temporary parole for the purpose. The prison's commander, valuing my services to the sick, did not wish me gone for long. I was in time to hold my daughter through the final hours of her life. I thank God for that gift, and for the gift that she was to her parents. Dorothea was desperately ill, but was spared by the mercy of God. She is still alive, but is sorely oppressed in both body and mind, and there was still much sickness in the town. I could not leave her. I know thy sense of military honour, but friends, do not hold the laws of man to be above those of God. I buried my child, and then broke my parole, taking Dorothea to a place of greater safety, where I might, with the goodness of God, try to heal her. I dare not write the name of the place where we are, for fear that this missive may be intercepted. I have no notion what penalty I might suffer for having broken my parole if I am captured, nor do I care. But if I am taken, or hanged, or shot, Dorothea will be alone, and she is in no condition to be left alone. I know thy love for her, and therefore trust that thee will send what help is possible. I have a friend who knows of her whereabouts and has been of the greatest assistance to us. Thy brother, I think, will discern his name and direction. Denzel Hunter. John dropped the letter as though it were on fire.
Oh, Jesus, Hal.
His brother had risen from the desk and was swaying, his face blank with shock, and the same grimy, crumpled white as the letter. John seized his brother, holding him as hard as he could. Hal felt like a tailor's dummy in his arms, save for a deep shudder that seemed to pass through him in long, rolling waves.
No, Hal whispered,
and his arms tightened round John's shoulders with a sudden convulsive strength.
No.
I know, John whispered. I know. He rubbed his brother's back, feeling the bony shoulder blades under the red broadcloth, repeating, I know, at intervals, as Hal shuddered and gasped for breath.
Shh, John said, rocking slowly from foot to foot, taking his brother's reluctant weight with him. He didn't expect Hal to shush, of course. It was just the only vaguely soothing thing he could think of to say. The next natural thing would have been to say, it'll be all right. But naturally, it never would. He'd been here before, he thought dimly, not in a cluttered office. It had been in the sala of an old house in Havana, a painted angel with spread wings fading on the plaster wall, who watched with compassion as he held his mother as she wept over the death of his cousin Olivia and her small daughter. His throat had a lump the size of a golf ball in it, but he couldn't give way now, any more than he had done in Havana. Hal was starting to wheeze in earnest. John could hear the gasp of his inhaled breath, the faint whistle as it went out.
Sit down, John said, and steered him to a chair. You've got to stop now. Any more and you won't be able to breathe, and I bloody don't know what to do about that, so you just bloody have to stop, he added firmly.
Hal sat, elbows on his knees and head in his hands. He was still shuddering, but the first shock of grief had passed, and John heard him now blowing out his breath and hauling it in again in a rhythmic, measured way that must be the technique Claire Fraser had taught him for not dying of asthma. John was, not for the first time in their shared acquaintance, grateful to her. He pulled up another chair and sat down, feeling as though his own insides had been scooped out. For a few seconds he couldn't think about anything. His mind had gone completely blank. He was gazing beyond Hal to a small table, though, and on it was a bottle of something. He got up and fetched the bottle, pulled the cork with his teeth, and took a gulp of the contents, not caring what it was. It was wine. He swallowed, breathed, then took Hal's hand and wrapped it round the bottle.
Dottie's alive, he said, and sat down. Remember, she's alive.
Is she?
Hal said between breaths.
She was. Is ill. Very ill. He said so.
Hunter is a physician and a good one, John said firmly. He won't let her die.
He let my granddaughter die,
Hal said passionately, forgetting to breathe. He coughed and choked, his grasp whitening on the neck of the wine bottle.
The child was his daughter, John said, taking it from him. He didn't let her die. People do die, and you know it. Stop talking and bloody breathe, will you?
I know better than anyone,
Hal managed, and succumbed to a fit of coughing. A hank of hair had come loose, and strands were sticking to his face. The dark hair was streaked with white. John couldn't tell how much was powder. Hal did know, of course. His first child had died at birth along with its mother. That had been many years ago, but such things never went away altogether.
Breathe, John said sharply. We have to fetch Dottie, don't we? I can't find her and then tell her first thing that you're dead.
Hal made a sound that wasn't a laugh, but might have been if he'd had more breath. He pursed his lips and blew, though the resulting air was only a thread. Then his chest relaxed. It was no more than a fraction, but it was visible, and John took a deep breath of his own. Hal stretched out a hand toward the letter on the desk, and John fetched it for him. He picked the ball gingerly apart, smoothing it flat on the table.
Why didn't he fucking write the bloody date?
Hal demanded, straightening up and wiping a hand roughly down his face.
We've no idea how long it's been since it happened. Dottie could be dead by now.
John forbore to point out that if that were the case, Hal's knowing the date of Hunter's letter would make no difference. It wasn't a moment for logic.
Well, we need to go and get her anyway, don't we?
Yes, and now.
Hal flung himself round, wheezing loudly and glaring at the things around him as though daring any of them to get in his way.
Perhaps just a little logic?
I don't know what the army would do to Hunter if they catch him, John said. But I know damn well what they do to you should you just go.
And so do you, he added needlessly.
Hal had got himself in hand. He glared at the letter, mouth tight and wet eyes burning, then looked up at John. He pursed, blew, and gasped.
Well, what does he mean? You can discern his friend's name. Why you?
I don't know. Let me see that again.
He took the letter gently, feeling the weight of sorrow it bore. He'd seen enough letters stained with tears, sometimes his own, to know the depth of Hunter's anguish. He had a good idea what Hunter meant by discern. The man had travelled in company with Jamie Fraser. He knew that much. And he knew that Fraser had been a Jacobite spy in Paris, among other things. The word spy gave him a disturbing echo of Percy, but he pushed it aside, holding the paper up to the light in case there should be secret writing in vinegar or milk. Sometimes you could see the faint difference in reflection on the paper's surface, even though the words would come into view only when heated. It was simpler than that. There were words written on the back of the letter, written lightly with a pencil. It looked like a brief paragraph written in Latin. The words were indeed Latin, but strung together without meaning. Even Hal could have recognized it as a coded message, though he wouldn't have known what to do with it. He smiled a little, despite the seriousness of the situation. It was a cipher, with friend as the key. 5 minutes' work gave him the name. Elmsworth, Wilkins Corner, Virginia.
We'll send William, he said to Hal, with as much confidence as he could manage. Don't worry, he'll bring her back.
William felt as though he'd been struck in the chest by a cannonball. His mouth opened and closed. He could feel it, automatic as the wooden jaws of a marionette. But nothing came out for a moment.
That's very terrible,
he managed at last in a strangled croak.
Sit down, Papa. You're going to fall.
His father did look as though someone had cut his strings, dead white, and his hand trembled when William pushed a glass of brandy into it. He looked round the inside of the little shed William shared with John's cinema as though he'd never seen it before, then sat down and drank the brandy.
Well, he said, coughed and cleared his throat. Well. Not all that well, William said, peering at him. How's Uncle Hal?
His own sense of shock was beginning to subside, though there was still an iron weight in his chest.
As you might expect, his father said,
and took a deep, wet breath.
Off his head, he added more clearly, having taken another large swallow. Wanting to ride off directly and fetch Dotty himself. Not that I blame him.
He took another.
I want to do that too. But I doubt that Sir Henry would see it that way. War, you know.
War indeed. Half the regiment was set to move on Tuesday to join Clinton's troops at Charlestown. The weight had shifted lower in his body, and he could breathe now.
I'll go, of course, William said, and in a softer tone added, Don't worry, Papa. I'll bring her back.
Chapter 99 Isaiah, Chapter 6, Verse 8
I'm sorry, Roger said at last. I had to.
It's all right, she said, keeping her voice steady. You're back. That's all that matters.
Well, maybe not all that matters,
he said, the ghost of laughter in his voice.
I haven't eaten since breakfast yesterday, and I smell like a rubbish fire.
His stomach growled loudly in agreement, and she laughed, letting go of him. Come on, she said, turning back to her horse. When we get to the house, just say hi to the kids and wash. I'll go and tell Henrika that we need food.
A lot of food.
A lot of food. Go!
She found both Henrika and Angelina in the kitchen with cook, buzzing excitedly. They pounced on her at once, wide-eyed and full of questions. Had Mr. Mackenzie seen the battle? Was he wounded? What had he said about the fighting? Had he seen General Prevost there, or Lord John? She felt as though Angelina had punched her in the stomach. She knew Lord John had been in the battle with his brother. She just hadn't thought through what that meant. Of course they had fought. Whether either of the Greys had fired a gun or drawn a sword, they had undoubtedly given orders, helped light the fuse that had blown up and killed American besiegers. She heard Lord John's voice in memory, light and reassuring. "We are His Majesty's army. We know how to do this sort of thing." All the blood had left her face and she felt cold and clammy. It hadn't occurred to her that they would think Roger had been with the British army. But of course, they would. It hadn't occurred to her that men she knew, liked, admired had killed other men for whom she felt the same just days ago. She felt the cold, stinking darkness of the tent where Casimir Pulaski lay dead by lantern light, and her right hand clenched, feeling the aching muscles and the film of sweat between the pencil and her skin as she'd sketched through the night, capturing sorrow, grief, rage, and love, as the soldiers came to say farewell. Pozignanya. She'd managed to ask for food to be sent, for someone to arrange a bath for Roger, and went up to her room, placing each foot carefully on the steps as she climbed the stairs. Roger's discarded clothes lay on the floor by the window, and the acrid smell of war hung in the air. Gingerly she gathered up the remains of Roger's black suit. It was filthy, coat and breeches mud-spattered from shoulder to knee, and grey sand sifted from the skirts when she shook it. There was a large rough patch on the breast of the coat where something had dried, nearly the same colour as the black broadcloth. But when she dabbed it with a wet rag, the cloth came away red, and with a faint, meaty smell of blood. There was something small and hard in the breast pocket. She hooked a finger inside and pulled out a brownish lump that proved to be a tooth, split, carious, and with half its roots missing. With a small huff of distaste, she set it on the table and returned to the coat. There had been something else in the pocket, a paper of some kind. It was a small note, folded once and stuck together with the blood that had saturated the coat, but the blood had dried, and she was able to separate the folds by delicate prying, flaking away the blood with the blade of her penknife. She shouldn't have been surprised. She'd smelled the powder smoke when she'd embraced him. Blood was a good deal more immediate, though. He hadn't just been near the battle, he'd been in it. And she wasn't sure whether to be more angry or more scared at the thought. "What's wrong with you?" she muttered under her breath. "Why, for God's sake?" She'd got the paper halfway open, far enough to see her own name. Very carefully, she broke the last of the dried blood and spread the stained and crumpled paper out on the table. "Dearest Bree, I'm sorry. I didn't mean to be here, but I have the strongest feeling that here is where I should be. It wasn't quite, whom shall I send? Who shall go for us? But something close, and so was my answer." Slowly she sat down on the bed with its clean, safe counterpane and spotless pillows, and read it again. She sat for a few minutes, breathing slowly, deeply, calming herself. She was by no means a Bible scholar, but she knew this passage. It turned up at least once a year in the readings at Mass, and the young priest who had taught religion at her school had used it when talking to the eighth graders about vocations. It was from Isaiah, the story in which the prophet is awakened from sleep by an angel who touches a hot coal to his lips to cleanse him, to make him capable of speaking God's word. She thought she knew what came next, but she rose and went down the quiet hallway to the library, where she knew she'd seen a Bible in the shelves. It was there, a handsome book bound in cool black leather, and she sat down and found what she was looking for with no trouble. Isaiah, chapter 6, verse 8.
Also I heard the voice of the Lord saying, Whom shall I send, and who will go for us? Then said I, Here am I, send me.
She could feel her lips moving, repeating, Send me. But they moved silently, and the words rang only in her own ears. Send me. She sat down, the open book heavy on her knee. Her hands were sweating, but her fingers were cold, and she fumbled, turning the page.
Then said I, Lord, how long? And he answered, Until the cities be wasted without inhabitant, and the houses without man, and the land be utterly desolate.
Jesus Christ, she whispered.
Roger had heard that call, and he'd answered it. She swallowed painfully, past the lump in her throat.
You're an idiot, she whispered.
But it was herself she spoke to, not him. She'd told him that she'd do everything she could to help him if he was sure that being a minister was truly his vocation. She'd been schooled by priests and nuns. She knew what a vocation was, only she hadn't really.
I'm sorry,
he'd written in his note to her.
No, I'm sorry, she said aloud, and closing the book, sat for a few minutes staring into the fire.
The house was quiet around her, wrapped in that peaceful hour before the preparations for supper began. She'd imagined him doing what he did on the ridge, though more officially, listen to people who needed someone to hear them, advise the troubled, comfort the dying, christen children, marry people and bury them. But she hadn't imagined him comforting men dying on a battlefield, in the midst of cannon fire, nor burying them afterward, and coming home bloody with a stranger's shattered tooth in his pocket. But something had called to him, and he'd gone to do it. And he had, thank God, come back to her, come in need of her. She blew out a long, slow breath, and rising, went to slide the Bible back into its place.
Whom shall I send? And who will go for us?
Well, there's a rhetorical question, she said. There isn't anybody else who can do that for him, is there? She took a breath, and clean air from the sea came in through the open window.
Send me.
Chapter 100. The Power of the Flesh. Savannah.
The siege was lifted, the city largely untouched by battle, save cannonball holes and minor fires in the houses closest to the fighting. Savannah was a gracious city, and its grace was still evident as people resumed their lives with very little fuss. John Gray picked up the handkerchief that Mrs. Fleury had just dropped for the second time, and handed it back, again with a bow. He didn't think it was flirtation. If it was, she was very bad at it. She was also a good quarter century his elder, and while she was still sharp of both eye and tongue, he'd noticed how the spoon rattled in her saucer when she'd picked up her teacup earlier in the afternoon. If her hands were palsied, though, her mind was not.
That girl, she said, pursing her lips toward Amaranthus, who stood on the other side of the room in conversation with a young man he didn't know.
Who is she?
That is Viscountess Grey, ma'am, Grey said courteously. And my brother's daughter-in-law.
Mrs. Fleury's slightly red-rimmed eyes narrowed in closer inspection.
Where's her husband?
Gray felt the usual qualm in his innards at mention of Ben, but answered smoothly,
My nephew had the misfortune to be captured by the rebels at the Brandywine, ma'am. We have had little news of him since, but hope that he will soon return to us.
Even if it is in a box.
Hal couldn't stand much more uncertainty, and he would have to write to Minnie soon. The old lady raised her quizzing glass.
Yes, definitely palsy. He could see the chain trembling against her bosom,
and gave Amaranthus a fierce stare through it.
That young lady don't act much like she's pining for him, does she?
Frankly, she didn't, but Gray didn't want to discuss his niece by marriage with Mrs. Fleury, who had used her widowhood to advantage, and was quite obviously an accomplished gossip.
She bears up bravely, he said. Allow me to fetch you another cup of tea, Mum.
While on this errand, he contrived to pass within hailing distance of Amaranthus and William, who were chatting with each other beneath a large portrait of the late Mr. Fleury, bewigged and dressed in plum velvet. This fine impression of a successful merchant was slightly spoilt by the artist's effort to add a prosperous paunch to an otherwise lean figure. The alteration had required a hasty adjustment to Mr. Fleury's posture, careless overpainting causing it to appear that the gentleman possessed a ghostly third leg, which hovered uncertainly behind William's left ear. There was no impropriety in their poses at all, but he was strongly aware of a charged atmosphere between them. It was visible in the effort they made not to touch each other. As Grey approached them, Amaranthus accepted a plate of cake from William with such delicacy of touch that he might have just fallen into a privy, whilst William smiled into her eyes with an expression that anyone who knew him could have read, and that Amaranthus certainly did.
Jesus Christ, surely they haven't. Maybe not, but they're bloody thinking about it, both of them.
That was disturbing on multiple grounds. He quite liked Amaranthus, for one thing, and as William's stepfather, he wanted to think the boy had been brought up better than to make addresses to a married woman, let alone his own cousin's wife. But he knew all too well the power of the flesh, strong enough to be visible to Mrs. Fleury, at any rate.
John, said a soft voice behind him, and he stiffened. Perseverance, Grey said, shaking his head as his erstwhile stepbrother came up beside him, smiling. Never was a man so well named.
You're looking well, John, Percy said, ignoring this. Blue velvet always suits you. You recall the suits we wore to our parents' wedding? The smile was real, deep in those soft brown eyes, and Grey was astonished and annoyed to feel it run straight down his backbone and tighten his balls.
Yes, he bloody remembered that wedding and those suits.
And, as Percy so clearly intended, he remembered standing beside Percy in church as his mother married Percy's stepfather, his hand and Percy's touching, hidden in full skirts of royal blue velvet, fingers slowly entwining, the touch of promise. One Percy had fucking broken.
What do you want, Perseverance? He asked bluntly.
Oh, quite a lot of things, Percy replied, the smile now reaching his lips. But principally, I want to talk to Fergus Fraser.
You did, Grey said, setting his half-empty glass on the tray of a passing servant.
At Coriel's Ferry, I heard you.
And I heard him, he added. He wasn't having any of you then, and I doubt he's changed his mind. Besides, what the devil do you think I could do about it, even if I wanted to?
Percy's smile remained, but his eyes crinkled in a way indicating that he considered Grey's reply to be humorous.
I had the pleasure of meeting your son in the summer at Mrs. Prevost's luncheon.
No, for God's sake, bloody no.
And while I did indeed meet Mr. Fergus Fraser again briefly in Charlestown some little time ago, I had also the privilege of seeing General Fraser at close range during the pourparlers before Monmouth.
So? Grey kept his own smile fixed blandly in place, though he was well aware that Percy could read in his eyes what he was thinking. Percy blinked, coughed once, and averted his gaze, fixing it instead upon Mr. Fleury's phantom leg.
Bugger off, Percy, Grey said not unkindly, and went to fetch Mrs. Fleury's tea.
The sense of warmth and faint sexual excitement remained with him, though, along with the disturbingly exhilarating sensation of Percy's eyes on his back. It had been a good many years since he'd felt Percy's touch, but he remembered it vividly. He pushed the feeling firmly away. He wasn't likely to succumb to Percy's physical charms, nor yet his clumsy blackmail. What if Percy did decide to go round telling the world that he thought William's resemblance to a Scottish rebel general rather striking? It might stimulate gossip for a brief time,
but William had left the army and remained an earl. His position couldn't really be endangered. All William would need to do, should any question be asked of him, was to give the querent an icy stare and ignore them. He was going to have to find out what Percy was up to, though, and why. A thread of heat ran down his back again, as though someone had poured hot coffee down his neckband. Across the room, he saw Amaranthus's long forefinger come to rest gently on William's chest, pointing out something obvious. Her finger rested, just barely, on the largest of the beetles on his waistcoat, a 2.5-inch monster in brilliant yellow silk, with black-tipped horns, and, of course, tiny red eyes. "Dynastes Titius," she said with approval. "The Eastern Hercules beetle." "Really?" William said, laughing. "Dynastes Titius means, if I'm not mistaken, Tithian rebel. Was Hercules a Tithian?" "A Titan, was he not?" Amaranthus tilted her head, lifting one brow. Her brows were soft but well marked, a darker blonde than her hair.
"Yes, perhaps that's what the person who named this thing meant, but why rebel? Is this fellow known to be rebellious?"
He looked down his nose at his chest, and Amaranthus's long, slim index finger. Her wedding band glimmered on the fourth finger, and he took a deep breath that made her pointing finger sink slowly into the ochre silk. She smiled up at him and slowly withdrew the finger.
"As to the beetle, I wouldn't know. But you are, aren't you?"
"Me? How do you mean?"
"I mean that you don't intend to live your life to please other people's expectations, do you?"
That was a lot more direct than he'd expected, but then she was startlingly direct.
"Your expectations?" he asked.
"Oh, no," she said, dimpling. "I expect nothing, William, from you or anyone else."
She paused for an instant, and her eyes fixed with his. They were grey now that she wore violet satin, and translucent as rain on a window pane.
"Unless you refer to the modest proposal I made you."
In spite of the internal struggle going on inside him, he smiled at her reference to Jonathan Swift, though in truth her own proposal had been nearly as shocking as Swift's satirical essay advocating infant cannibalism as a remedy for poverty.
"That was what I had in mind, yes."
"I'm pleased to know that you're considering it," she said,
and though the dimple had left her cheek, it was plainly audible in her voice. He opened his mouth to deny that he was doing any such thing, but while he had firmly refused to think about her outrageous suggestion, he was aware that his body had already accomplished its considerations and was making its equally firm conclusions known to him. He coughed and glanced casually around the room. Papa was talking to the French diplomat and not looking in his direction, thank God.
"Well,"
he cleared his throat and folded his hands behind his back.
"I don't know that consideration is the right word precisely, but the matter is irrelevant for the moment. I came this afternoon to see you."
"Indeed?"
She looked pleased. "In order to tell you that I am leaving in the morning and don't know how long it may be until I return." She ceased looking pleased, and he regretted that, but there was nothing to be done about it. "Come," he said, and touched her hand, nodding toward the French doors open to the garden. "I'll tell you why." She caught his mood at once and gave a slight nod.
"Not together," she said. "I'll go first. Go and have a drink, then take your leave through the front door and walk round."
He found her at length at the far end of Mrs. Fleury's enormous garden, contemplating a small grotto in which a stone puto was urinating on a toad that sat in the middle of a carved stone basin, its round eyes gleaming black beneath the stream.
"It's a real toad," she remarked, glancing briefly at him before returning her attention to the amphibian in question. "A Scaphiopus of some kind. They live mostly underground, but they do like water."
"Obviously," William said.
But he wasn't letting her distract him,
and without ado he told her about the letter Denzel Hunter had sent to Uncle Hal. She went white and pulled her cape tight across her body as though stricken by a sudden chill.
Oh, no, no! Oh, poor woman!
To his surprise, her eyes were full of tears, but then he remembered that she too had a child and must at once have imagined losing Trevor in such fashion.
Yes, he said, a lump in his own throat. It's very terrible. Uncle Hal naturally wants Dottie here where he can take care of her, make sure she's safe. So I'm going to go and fetch her.
Of course.
Amaranthus's voice was unaccustomedly hoarse, and she cleared her throat with a small precise then let go of her cape, straightening up.
I'm glad that your cousin will be restored to her family. To be alone was such a dreadful loss. How long do you think the journey will take?
I don't know, William said. If everything goes smoothly, perhaps a month, 6 weeks. If it doesn't, illness, bad weather, travel mishaps, troop movements.
As usual, he felt a slight pang at thought of the army and the sense of constant purpose it embodied.
It could be longer.
Amaranthus nodded. The toad suddenly inflated its throat and let rip an enormous, resonant wonk. It repeated this cry several times as William and Amaranthus watched it in astonishment, then gave them an accusing look and shuffled out of its basin and away under a frond of something green. Amaranthus giggled, and William smiled, charmed at the sound. The tension between them had broken, and he reached to draw the cape back around her shoulders, quite naturally. Just as naturally, she stepped into his arms, and no one could have said then, or afterward, whose idea the kiss had been, nor yet what followed. Chapter 101. On the Road Again. John Cinnamon heaved William's saddlebags aboard the mare, then looked the animal over carefully, circling her with squinted eyes, trying to pick up her forefoot, attempting to tighten the cinch and loosening it in the process, and generally annoying the horse. Cinnamon was somewhat embarrassed at being rescued from the Saint-Domingue Navy and had been taking particular care not to be a nuisance since the adventure. She's a good horse, but she'll probably kick you if you don't leave off pestering her. William was amused, but also moved at Cinnamon's clumsy solicitude. He knew Cinnamon wished to go with him, probably not trusting him to manage the task of retrieving Dottie by himself without being arrested, hanged by accident, or killed by highwaymen, but not enough to leave without his portrait being finished. It will be all right, he said, clapping Cinnamon on the shoulder and bending to retighten the cinch. It will be nearly winter by the time I get to Virginia. Armies don't fight in winter. I've been in the army, I know.
Yes, imbecile, Cinnamon replied mildly. I know. Didn't you tell me that the last time you were in the army you got hit on the head by a German deserter and thrown into a ravine where you almost died and had to be rescued by your Scottish cousin that you hate?
I don't hate Ian Murray, William said with some coldness. I owe him my life, after all.
Which is why you hate him,
Cinnamon said matter-of-factly and handed William his own best knife with the beaded sheath.
That? And you want his wife. Don't tell me it will be all right. I've seen what kind of trouble you get into when you are with me. I'll light a candle to the Blessed Virgin every day until you come back with your cousin.
Merci beaucoup, William said, with elaborate sarcasm.
You don't have that much money.
But he meant it, and Cinnamon grinned at him.
Have you got a good thick cloak and woolen drawers to keep your balls warm?
You look after your own balls, William advised him, putting his foot in the stirrup. Mind yourself, and do what my sister tells you. Cinnamon widened his eyes and crossed himself.
You think I would dare to do otherwise? He said. That is a fearsome woman. Beautiful, he added thoughtfully, but large and dangerous. And besides, I want my portrait to look like me, if I made her angry.
He crossed his eyes and stuck his tongue out of the corner of his mouth. William laughed, and tucking the knife into his belt, patted it and took up the reins.
Serve you right, Gons.
Adieu.
Cinnamon shook his head.
Au revoir,
he corrected soberly.
Et bon voyage.
Chapter 102. The Winds of Winter. Bar a few showers and one day of solid rain, the weather held and the roads weren't bad. As for armies, though, his job was to retrieve Dottie and bring her home. No one had mentioned her husband, who was presumably still an escaped prisoner of war. Granted, Denzel Hunter might be with Dottie in Virginia, but if he weren't... He knew his cousin well. He knew Denzel Hunter well, too, and thought that once Dottie was safe, Hunter would likely have returned to the Continental Army as a matter of personal belief, as well as military duty. Uncle Hal had showed him the official dispatches and told him what General Prevost supposed to be true regarding both British and American troop dispositions. Winter was coming, and all hostilities had essentially ceased up north. Sir Henry Clinton had been lurking in New York since Monmouth, and George Washington, according to Hal's dispatches, which his uncle had thought likely accurate, was still keeping the main body of his men in winter quarters in New Jersey. One of Washington's generals, though, Lincoln, the man who'd mounted the unsuccessful siege of Savannah, had gone north with his troops and was presently holding the city of Charlestown, and Clinton wanted it.
So, according to the latest, Sir Henry was intending to send some 14,000 troops down the coast to take the place once D'Estaing's frogs quit New York, but he was delayed by needing to go and protect Newport, which is where the frogs went next.
Uncle Hal had riffled through the small stack of dispatches, peering through his half-spectacles,
and then the frogs bloody turn up here. You did say you thought you'd seen D'Estaing himself.
With my own eyes, William assured his uncle, who snorted briefly.
And we know that Lincoln left here after the siege failed and went up to hold Charlestown, which put something of a stumbling block in Clinton's path,
Lord John had put in.
Being that winter is coming, Sir Henry's intentions may have been further delayed by the weather and the minor problem of housing his 14,000 troops, in case Benjamin Lincoln doesn't immediately oblige by surrendering Charlestown. That being so, I've no idea what you might find if you go through Charlestown, or anywhere near it, but it would be a lot faster to go through Charlestown than round it.
William finished smiling. Don't worry, Uncle Hal. I'll get to Virginia as quickly as I possibly can. Uncle Hal's face, shadowed with tiredness and worry, relaxed into one of those rare, charming smiles that made you feel as though everything would be fine. Because surely the world could not resist him.
I know you will, Willie, he said with affection. Thank you.
William had therefore set out on his mission with a warm heart, stout boots, a good horse, and a purse full of gold. Uncle Hal, meaning to ensure that he would lack for nothing in transporting Dorothea back to her father's arms. Uncle Hal hadn't happened to mention any role for Denzel Hunter in these transactions, but Lord John eventually had.
He's a Quaker, of course, he told William privately, but he's also a surgeon in the Continental Army and an escaped prisoner of war. He broke his parole, he says. He may be with Washington now, which means he's likely in New Jersey. If he is, bloody leave him there and bring Dottie back with you at once, no matter what she says or does to you. She's a Quaker now, isn't she? William asked. She won't do anything violent.
Lord John gave him a look.
Somehow I doubt that religious conviction will be sufficient to overcome Dorothea's familial tendencies toward high-handedness. Remember who her bloody father is.
William said noncommittally. He was, in fact, recalling the last time he'd told a young Quaker woman, Denzel Hunter's bloody sister, no less, that she wouldn't strike him. She'd slapped his face. She'd also called him a rooster, which he rather resented. William hadn't given Denzel much thought during the discussion of Dottie's rescue, but if he had, he would have come to the same conclusion as had Papa and Uncle Hal. He would, he thought, send word to Denzel as to Dottie's whereabouts and well-being, at least. William was feeling at once slightly heroic, sentimental, and magnanimous. This was largely due to his current feelings regarding Amaranthus, which were confused, but suffusingly pleasant. Half of him urgently wished he had taken advantage of Mrs. Fleury's summer house to accomplish the first step of the plan Amaranthus had suggested to him. The other half was rather glad he hadn't. In fact, he hadn't, largely, because of Dottie's baby and Amaranthus's reaction to news of her death, which had abruptly made the child real to him. Before seeing Amaranthus's sudden tears, he had himself felt the sadness of the situation, but it was an abstract sadness, safely distant from himself. But when Amaranthus wept for the child, he had been struck quite suddenly and painfully by the realization that she, little Minerva Joy, had been an actual person, one whose death had grievously wounded those who had loved her for however short a time. It was the tenderness engendered by this thought as much as lust that had made him touch Amaranthus, enter that kiss. He touched his own lips with the back of his hand. Such a strange kiss, and somehow wonderful. For those few moments when their lips had met and their bodies pressed together, kindling each other in the wet, chilly garden, it was as though some connection had been forged between them, as though he knew her now in some way beyond words. And he'd bloody wanted to know her a lot further, and she him. At one point he slid his hand up the long bare thigh under her skirts, taken her mound in the palm of his hand, and felt the fullness, the slickness of her, wanting him. The pads of his fingers rubbed half-consciously against his palm, tingling. He swallowed and tried to put the memories of Amaranthus away. For now. But the tenderness remained, and the thought of the baby. That's why he'd stopped, because it had suddenly occurred to him that what he was doing might in fact cause someone real to be born, and that it somehow wasn't right that he should oblige that someone to take on burdens that were, rightfully or not, his own to bear. But if I married her and didn't go away, if she fell pregnant? His son. God, what a thought. His son would still inherit Ellesmere's title and Dunsany's, but not until he was ready for it. He could prepare the boy, show him. Jesus. He shook his head violently, driving out the thoughts, or trying to. The notion was new, frightening, and quite thrilling in a way. He pushed it aside, his mind sliding back to its memories of Amaranthus and her soft blonde brows, trickling water, pungent grass, and the gleaming black eyes of the watchful toad. He barely noticed the miles pacing away beneath his horse's hooves, and stopped only when darkness made the road disappear. Chapter 103. Virginia Reel. He stopped for the night in a hamlet some 30 miles north of Richmond. William felt the pull of Mount Josiah. He'd passed within a few miles of the road that would take him there, and for a few moments he was there in spirit, sitting on the broken porch with Manoak and John Cinnamon, eating fried catfish and pig meat smoked underground, the faint, sweet scent of tobacco riding on the evening breeze. He wondered briefly whether perhaps he should take Dottie there for a while. The weather was getting colder and rain more frequent. A newly bereaved woman, weakened by illness, surely oughtn't to be required to ride through storms and mud for weeks. And if Manoak was still in residence, he and the Indian could easily repair enough of the house to give them shelter. No, this was a fantasy, born of his own desire to sit still on his shattered stoop and think about things. He needed to get Dottie back to Uncle Hal as soon as possible, where she could be taken care of, heal in the bosom of her family. And, said a small treacherous voice in the back of his mind, you might just want to see Amaranthus again before too long. That too, he said aloud, and nudged his horse into a faster pace. He had enough money to bring Dottie back by coach, but that was assuming a coach was to be had. The settlement of Wilkins Corner boasted 3 oxen, 1 mule, and a small herd of goats, plus the odd pig or two. There were only 4 houses, and a brief inquiry of a woman milking a goat sent him directly to the door of Fear God Elmsworth. This gentleman proved to be in his 80s and quite deaf, but his much younger wife, only 60 or so, was able, by shouting into his ear at a distance of 2 inches, to get across to him William's identity and mission.
Dorothea, you say? Mr. Elmsworth cocked a bushy brow at William. What does he want with her?
I am her cousin, William said, leaning down to address the old gentleman at the top of his voice.
Cousin? Cousin?
The old man looked at his wife for confirmation of this unlikely statement, and receiving it, shook his head.
You don't look nothing like her.
William turned to the wife.
Would you please tell your husband that Dorothea's father is my uncle, and his brother is my stepfather?
The woman heard this, but was plainly baffled by the genealogical information, for she opened her mouth for a moment, then shut it, frowning.
Never mind, William said, keeping his patience.
Please, just tell Dorothea that I'm here.
Dorothea ain't here, said Mr. Elmsworth,
somehow catching this. He looked puzzled and glanced at his wife.
Is she?
No, she isn't, said Mrs. Elmsworth, looking puzzled as well. William took a deep breath and decided that shaking Mrs. Elmsworth until her head rattled wouldn't be the act of a gentleman.
Where is she? He inquired gently.
Mrs. Elmsworth looked surprised.
Why, her brother came and fetched her near on a month ago.
William had nodded in automatic response to Mrs. Elmsworth, but then actually heard what she'd said and jerked as though stung by a bee.
Her brother,
he repeated carefully, and both the old people nodded.
Her brother. What was his name?
Mr. Elmsworth, who was now lighting his long-stemmed clay pipe, removed it from his mouth long enough to say,
Eh?
He don't know, Mrs. Elmsworth said, shaking her capped head in apology. I was working in the orchard when the man came, and by the time I came back, they'd gone away together. Dorothea left a sweet note, thanking us for looking after her, but she said nothing about her brother's name in it, and my husband was too deaf to understand what they said, beyond them making signs to him. Ah.
It was possible that Mr. Elmsworth had misunderstood the situation entirely, William reflected, but it was just possible that it had been Henry. When last he'd seen Henry Gray, the man had been living in Philadelphia with a very handsome Negro landlady, who might or might not be a widow, recovering slowly from having lost a foot or two of his guts after being shot in the abdomen. William supposed that Denzel might have paused in Philadelphia on his way to New Jersey, and given Henry word of Dorothea's presence, and either had asked Henry to go and fetch her, or Henry had determined to do so on his own. A sudden thought struck him, though, and he inflated his lungs, leaned down close to Mr. Elmsworth's hairy ear hole, and shouted, Did he wear a uniform? Mr. Elmsworth started and dropped his pipe, which his wife fortunately caught before it could shatter on the floor.
Goodness, young man, he said reprovingly. 'Tisn't manners to shout indoors. That's what I was always taught as a young'un.
I beg pardon, sir, William said in a slightly lower tone. Mrs. Hunter has 2 brothers, you see. I wondered which it might be.
Henry had been invalided out of the army, but his elder brother Adam, the middle one of William's 3 cousins, was captain in an infantry battalion.
"Oh, ah,"
said Mrs. Elmsworth, and set about questioning her husband in a high-pitched howl, eventually eliciting a dubious opinion that the young fellow might have been in some sort of uniform, though with so many folk going about with guns and coloured breeches and fancy buttons these days, 'twas hard to say.
"We don't hold with vanity, see," he explained to William, "being friends like. Not with armies, nor guns, neither, save they're for hunting. Hunting's all right. Folk have to eat, you know," he added, giving William a faintly accusatory look.
William kept his patience, there being no choice, and was rewarded with a more promising thought. He turned to Mrs. Elmsworth.
"Will you ask your husband, please, did the man who came for Dorothea resemble her?"
For Henry and Benjamin were slender and dark-haired like their father, but Adam looked like his mother, as did Dotty, both being fair-haired and pink-cheeked, with rounded chins and large, dreamy blue eyes. Mr. Elmsworth had grown somewhat tense during the questioning and was puffing on his pipe with an air of agitation, but relaxed when this was put to him. He exhaled a great cloud of blue smoke and nodded hard.
"He did, then," he said. "Very like. Very like. Adam."
William relaxed, too, and thanked the Elmsworth profusely, though they refused any gift of money. As he prepared to take his leave, he had another thought.
"Ma'am, do you still have the note my cousin wrote to you?"
This request resulted in a quarter hour of fussing about the tiny house, picking up sticky jars of preserves and putting them down again, and concluding in Mr. Elmsworth's belated recollection that he had used the note to light his candle.
"There wasn't much to it, son," Mrs. Elmsworth told him sympathetically, seeing his disappointment. "She only thanked us for keeping her, and said as how her brother would take her to her husband."
It was late in the day by now, and his horse was tired and in need of food, so despite his urge to ride off immediately, he reluctantly accepted the hospitality of the Elmsworth's small barn for the night. They had invited him to share their supper as well, but having seen that their supper was to consist of a dab of cornmeal porridge, with a few drops of molasses, and a few slices of hard and curling bread, he assured them that he had a little food in his saddlebags, and retired to the barn to see to Betsy's needs before seeking the refuge of his own thoughts. In fact, he had a bruised apple and a small chunk of hard cheese, this oozing grease and slightly mouldy. He paid little attention to his sparse supper, though, his mind being occupied with what the devil to do next. Adam. It had to be Adam. The problem was that he didn't know where Adam was supposed to be. He'd not seen his cousin in more than a year, and such conversation as he'd had lately with Papa and Uncle Hal hadn't touched on Adam at all, everyone being taken up with Benjamin's death. The last he had heard of Adam, his cousin was a captain of infantry, but wisely, he thought, not in his father's regiment. Hal's sons had all concluded early in their military careers that their chances of remaining on good terms with their father depended on not serving under him, and they purchased their commissions accordingly.
"Well, start from the other end then, ass," he said impatiently.
The only way Adam would have found out where Dotty was is from Denzel. We assume Denzel is with Washington, and Uncle Hal says that Washington is in winter quarters in New Jersey. All right, then. He belched slightly, tasting the sweet decay of the apple's soft spots, and relaxed a little, hunching his greatcoat up around his ears and curling his toes inside his cold, damp boots. He didn't need to know where Adam was or had been, if this reasoning was sound, but his guess was that Adam was with Clinton's army in New York, if they were still in New York. If Clinton was intending to take Charlestown, though, surely he wouldn't be doing it so late in the year. Still, if the hunters were not with Washington in New Jersey, Adam was his only source of information as to their whereabouts. Betsy lifted her tail and deposited a steaming cascade of horse apples 2 feet away from where William sat on an upturned pail. William leaned over and rubbed his frozen hands above the warmth, thinking. He did wonder why Denzel had decided to send for Dotty, having placed her with the Elmsworth for safety, but that wasn't important. His own choice seemed clear. Either ride on to New York and look for Adam, go to New Jersey and look for Denzel, or turn round and ride back to Savannah and tell Uncle Hal what he'd learned. He dismissed this last option. It was roughly the same distance from where he was to either New York or New Jersey, about 300 miles. He glanced out through the open half door at the cloudy sky. Maybe a week if the roads were decent. Which they won't be, he said, watching small hard flecks of what wasn't quite yet snow drift into land on his hands and face, melting in tiny pinpricks of cold. Nothing else to do, though, is there? The new year had come before William arrived at Morristown. He'd had plenty of time on the road to make his decision, and while he assured himself that Morristown was the logical place to begin his inquiries, since this was where Denzel was, and Dotty would likely be with him by now, his conscience observed acidly that this decision was the counsel of cowardice as much as logic. He didn't want to walk into Sir Henry Clinton's headquarters as a shabbily dressed civilian and face the stares, if not the blunt questions, of men he knew. He just didn't. Morristown itself boasted 2 churches and 2 taverns, with a cluster of maybe 50 houses, and a large mansion near the edge of town. From the flags adorning this house and the sentries before it, it was evidently now Washington's headquarters. William wouldn't mind seeing the fellow, but curiosity could wait. Curiosity, though, caused him to ask someone on the town green why so many folk were waiting outside the churches, lined up and stamping their feet against the cold. Smallpox, he was told. Inoculations. General Washington's orders. Troops and townspeople alike, like it or not. They've been doing it in the churches every Monday and Wednesday. William had heard of inoculation for smallpox. Mother Claire had mentioned it once in Philadelphia. Inoculation meant doctors, and Washington's name meant army doctors. Thanking his informant, he strode to the head of one line and, tipping his hat to the person at the door, pushed his way inside as though he had a right to be there. A doctor and his assistant were working near the baptismal font at the front of the church, using the altar for their supplies. The doctor wasn't Denzel Hunter, but he was a place to start, and William strode purposefully up the aisle, drawing surprised looks from people waiting. The doctor, a fat gentleman with an eared cap pulled down over his brow and a bloody apron, was standing by the baptismal font, the structure having been temporarily topped with a wide piece of board, on which were the tools of inoculation, 2 small knives, a pair of forceps, and a bowl full of what looked like very thin dark red worms. As William approached, he saw the doctor, his breath wreathing round his face, cut a small slit in the hand of a woman who had turned her face away, grimacing at the cut. The doctor swiftly wiped away the welling blood, picked up one of the worms, which turned out to be thread soaked in something nasty. Smallpox? William wondered with a brief shudder, with his forceps, and tucked it into the wound. As the woman wrapped her hand in a handkerchief, William deftly inserted himself at the head of the queue. "I beg your pardon, sir," William said politely and bowed.